All right, I'm going to tell y'all how I like to use one of my favorite tools out in the woods, and that is the tracker from Onyx Hunt. So here's how I've been using it lately. I got this new property I'm going to be hunting this year, and the very first thing I did on the property was I went out and I drove all of the roads that are drivable in my truck, and I had the tracker on as I was driving around. So after I got done driving around, I selected the track on my app and changed it to where it's just a solid black line. So now I've got a really nice, easy to see roadmap of everywhere that's drivable in a truck on the property. So here's what that does for me so far. Now I've got an easy to read map of everywhere that you can drive in a truck on the property. But also that roadmap is actually very useful because it makes it very easy for me to see what roads are drivable and what parts of the property are most accessible and what parts of the property are least accessible. Like I said, one of my favorite tools. If you're not using it already, you should be. And if you want to give Onyx a try, go get an Elite membership and use the promo code Southern at checkout. That's going to save you 20% and it's going to help the show out. Know where you stand with Onyx Hunt. If you hunt deer out of trees, you need to go check out latitudeoutdoors.com. They got a little something for everybody, whether you're a saddle guy or if you hunt out of a climber. Of course, Latitude makes some of our favorite saddles and climbing sticks, but they also make some great packs and backpack straps that you can attach to the bottom of a climbing tree stand to make it more comfortable to carry in the woods. Probably my favorite piece of gear I've gotten in the last several years is the Ranger 22 from Latitude. It's like a do-it-all backpack for me. It's compact, which I like, but it's adjustable enough that it gets me through the whole season. It's the only pack I use. I use it in early bow season, when I'm not carrying much in the woods, all the way to late January rut hunts in the deep south when it's cold and I'm carrying all kinds of clothes and all kinds of stuff on my back. The Ranger 22 is adjustable enough that I can just use that one backpack all season. And hey, all you Mossy Oak Bottomland fans, they just released the Ranger 22 in Mossy Oak Bottomland. So like I said, no matter how you like to hunt, Latitude's got something for you. Go check them out at latitudeoutdoors.com.
Well, guys, meet your new favorite summer scouting optic, and no, it's never too early to start scouting for the fall. Introducing the Vortex Crossfire Spotting Scopes with three different models of how you glass. Me and Andrew have both used spotting scopes in the summer to go out and glass fresh, clear cuts that's got a little bit of growth on them to find bachelor groups actually feeding in the summer. It's a pretty fun time, and also it's a great opportunity to take your kids out, especially if you can sit in the truck while you're glassing. It's always one of those pieces of optics like to keep in the truck at all times because you never know when you might need it. Be sure to stop by your local Vortex dealer to get out the all-new Crossfire Spotting Scopes or to get 10% off your favorite spotter, head over to eurooptic.com and enter code Southern10 at checkout to save 10% on your order.
You know, one reason that we named our company the Southern Outdoorsman is because we're not just Southern deer hunters or Southern turkey hunters. We kind of hunt everything: quail, doves, waterfowl, rabbits, squirrels, you name it. I know a lot of you guys are the same way, and our friends at Whitetail Hill are like that as well. Whether you've got a hunting club, a lease, or your own property, they've got a blend for pretty much every situation on a piece of ground. I mean, they've got a seed blend for everything. If you want warm season deer forage, check out Summer Bulk. If you need to screen off a plot or cover an access route, Hideaway grows up to 12 feet tall and is built for that exact purpose. You got a duck hole or a pond edge? Check out the waterfowl blend. You want to plant for doves or quail? Check out their dove and quail plot. If you need soil that needs a little bit of work before fall, check out Dirt Doctor. And of course, they got a full cool season lineup ready to go when fall planting time gets here. And if you're unsure about what to plant, go to whitetailhill.com. They've got a seed selection guide on there that'll help you pinpoint exactly what you need on your property. So y'all check them out today. That's Whitetail Hill. Go to whitetailhill.com.
Going back to some of the properties that I've managed, I'd suggest these hunters that were hunting there said, I want you to shoot 4-year-old deer. They'd hunt their butts off. And they'd come to me and says, you're lying. We don't have any 4-year-old. I don't know what happened. They're not here. You know, there are no old deer here. So I'd call the local game warden and I'd say, hey, meet me tonight at about midnight at such and such a place. We're going to take these guys out and show them some deer. So the warden would show up. We'd go out and we'd show these guys deer that they had no idea that were on their property. Now, there's been research that shows supposedly very recently that moon phase and none of these other things have anything to do, that deer die early. They move in the morning, they move in the afternoon. Well, about 70 years of hunting experience and 50 years of that as a professional wildlife biologist, that's BS. But I have taken more big, older mature buck during that middle of the daytime than any other time. And that, to me, is when those nocturnal bucks move.
Larry Weishen, thank you for inviting us here to do this podcast.
I'm truly honored to have you guys here. I've heard a little bit about you in the past and had an opportunity to do a little bit of research, and I'm impressed with what you guys are doing, and I'm very appreciative of what you're doing as well, too.
Well, thank you, and thanks to our buddy, our mutual friend, Seth Johnson, Team Texas Wild. Great guy, and he's got a great YouTube channel everyone should go watch. But you were on his show, and I had learned about you by reading your book. I think I'd seen you on TV and everything before, but when I really got dialed in on you was I read your book, Southern Deer and Deer Hunting?
It was Southern Deer and Deer Hunting. Goes back to years ago when I was on staff with the Deer and Deer Hunting magazine, and the gentleman I was doing that with was there on staff as well, too. So great. It was great fun writing that book, to be very honest with you. I hunted all over the South. I know you guys, I think, are from Alabama, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
I've spent a fair time in Alabama hunting in years past, pretty much all over the state, particularly probably from about the southern two-thirds of it.
Really?
Yes, sir.
Interesting. We might have to get into that a little bit. I remember reading that book, and you co-authored it with Bill Bynum.
Bill Bynum, absolutely.
And I remember there was an article or a chapter in there. I don't know if it was you or Bill that wrote it, but you were talking about, it was talking about, I think, bow hunting around clear cuts and the SMZs around clear cuts and dragging deadfall and limbs and making like a fence through the woods to funnel the deer. I'm like, I got to talk to these guys.
Yeah, we did all those kind of things. Bill, unfortunately, passed away about a year ago now, but Bill was kind of the reincarnation of Davy Crockett when you get right down to it. I mean, great woodsman when he comes right down to it and finding his way around in the woods, knowing about the animals, about the fish as well, too, and a great shot and all those other kind of good things, and an unbelievable storyteller.
Yeah, well, we'll get into that.
Okay.
Larry, so we're in Texas right now.
Yes, sir.
I don't know if we mentioned that. Beautiful town that we're in, by the way. Did you grow up here?
I grew up almost exactly 26 miles due south of where we are right now in a little German-speaking community called Zimmerscheid. Grew up in that community where almost everybody spoke German and very little English. So really almost until I got into grade school that I could even speak English. I could understand it, but I really was kind of afraid to speak it because I didn't know all the right words to say kind of thing. But grew up out in the country with a dad that loved coonhounds. He loved to hunt. He loved horses. And a granddad that his goal in life was to have a freckle-faced, red-haired grandkid, and I just happened to be the one. And I see somebody else I'm looking at got that kind of hair color that I used to have. Not there anymore, but I do still remember it when it was that way. But I grew up out, literally out in the woods kind of thing. And my granddad was a county commissioner, and he'd come by and pick me up. And during the fall, we'd go hunt squirrels and go fishing and dug worms, earthworms, and fished year-round and hunted deer in the fall. But back then, we didn't have the deer populations that we have now. And quite frankly, back then, if you even saw a deer track, you know, you talked about it for weeks. And if you happen to see a deer, oh my gosh, that's something very special. And if you happen to actually shoot one during that 6 weeks of deer season, oh my God, you were the hero for that entire community for the entire year until somebody else maybe, and then they were a hero for a little bit, but you were both heroes for the rest of the year. So I grew up in those kind of situations out in the woods, and very frankly, when I had to finally go to grade school, I thought I'd died and been sentenced to hell because I love the outdoors and could not imagine, you know, having to spend time in school. And that really wasn't what I wanted to do, but I learned, didn't take me too long to learn that if I ever wanted to do what I wanted to do and continue to be involved in wildlife, particularly as a wildlife biologist, I ended up having to stay in school and ended up getting a degree from wildlife science at Texas A&M University.
Okay. You know, by the way, just a quick note on the deer population. I did not realize that about Texas, especially this part of Texas, because that's very common across the Southeast. Like in Alabama, like our grandfather's generation, 60s, 50s, if you found a deer track, you'd go tell all your buddies about it.
Absolutely. And a big part of that is some of y'all's country, like a lot of Texas, had a screw worm. And screw worm is a fly that had the larval stage eats live flesh. So what would happen is if a deer got a scratch, the female lay eggs, and then the larval would form, and they'd literally eat this deer up from the inside out. The biggest problem came during the time when they were having fawns, because if they had a fawn when that navel cord was still wet, the flies would lay eggs on it, and they would go into the body and just essentially eat this animal from the inside out. Then when the navel cord dried and started to fall off, there was a little bit of sore right there. Again, the eggs were laid. And so we ended up with not having any kind of reproduction year after year after year, or very minimal reproduction year after year. And that really kind of suppressed that deer herd throughout the Southeast and particularly here in Texas. And it wasn't until they figured out that a screwworm fly female would only mate one time. And so they applied radiation to billions of flies and dropped them all over the place. And we essentially kind of bred the screwworm fly out of existence. And now they're starting to come back in from Mexico a little bit. So hopefully we can stay on top of that, because those flies can be extremely devastating. Anything that's warm-blooded, including turkeys and any of the birds, any of the mammals, even humans sometimes will have them as well, too. So, but that was a big suppressor. And once we control that, the population, and just, my gosh, they just blossomed and bloomed all over the country.
That is incredible. I've heard a little bit about that, but that's horrific. That's a terrible way to die.
It really was. It made so many things come. I mean, we didn't have hardly any. You didn't have a whole lot of predators. You didn't have a whole lot of wildlife, you know, and you had to be constantly on top of your dogs, your cats, your livestock that you had to make sure that you weren't having the same problem there that we were having with it in the wildlife side of things.
Now, I don't know if you might know this or not, but where did those come from? Was that a natural North American
thing? They were an endemic species, the screwworm fly, to the southern probably third of the U.S.
Interesting. Okay. Wow. Well, I'm glad they got that taken care of.
Yeah, we need to stay on top of it, because now there's some screwworm flies moving out of Mexico back into toward Texas, and thankfully our current government is kind of not really staying on top of it yet, but it takes a while to ramp things up where they can produce enough flies. They probably need to release somewhere in the neighborhood of 600,000-700,000 flies a day. And to get those numbers up right now, there's one plant that produces them, and that's down in Panama. So they have to be shipped from Panama to Mexico and then into the lower part of Texas. And they're going in specifically into these areas and dropping these flies now, where there's a little bit more conducive to that kind of fly than it is just generally across the entire area.
Wow, that's fascinating. Wow. Yeah. So you got a degree in biology from Texas A&M. Yeah. So right out of college, did you become a wildlife biologist?
I was very fortunate. I went to work for the Wildlife Disease Project at Texas A&M under contract with the Department of Veterinary Pathology and Texas Parks and Wildlife Department as a senior. And we were involved very much in doing a lot of the early nutritional research, but also a lot of the disease research on the native species and some of the exotic species that were being brought in. So to answer your question, yeah, I actually went to work as a biologist before I got out of college, and then worked for Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for a while statewide, and worked with all kinds of different projects after that for a little bit. And then I was what we call the technical assistance wildlife biologist for the southern third of Texas, setting up management programs with landowners and hunting groups all across southern part of Texas on private land. And during that time, I spent, I'd crawl in a helicopter, do game surveys in mid-August, crawl out in the middle of November, crawl back in after Christmas until about the time the antlers started coming off in April, March and April, and then surveys and looking at the property and then setting up management programs from that, literally from the ground up, dealing with everything from livestock to water to habitat improvements, and also trying to determine what our harvest rates needed to be on both bucks and does each year to try to continually improve the property in terms of habitat, not only just for white-tailed deer, but for all the other game species, and particularly the non-game species that live there. Because once you set up a management program to try to really produce quality, healthy animals as far as game species are concerned, it's always the habitat and the non-game species that benefit so much more. And that's one of the reasons it's so important when it comes to hunting and when it comes to management.
Back then, I don't know about what year that was. Like, what year was that, first of all? And second of all, back then, when it comes to the whitetails, were you guys just trying to increase your numbers of whitetails, or was there a focus on quality buck management back then?
Primarily back then, we're talking about starting in the mid-1970s. We started noticing a tremendous decline in quality in the brush country of South Texas, which traditionally produced the biggest antlers and better deer in South Texas. and actually had a did check stations back then to gather all the data and all those kind of things. And then it was more about trying to improve the habitat and improve the quality of the animals in terms of providing nutrition, getting them into the older age classes so that they had the opportunity to show what they were capable of genetically wise as far as antlers concerned. So it was really having to do with quality. About that time, two guys, dear friends of mine, Al Brothers, Murphy Ray, wrote a book called Producing Quality Whitetail. And that kind of served as the basis for so many different things as we move forward. I was very fortunate to work with them on some of the early projects they were doing at the time through our disease project, but also through some of the management work we were doing. And so it started there, and then it just kind of started building from there. We started seeing results, and guess what? We had all of a sudden South Texas brush country became the mecca for white-tailed deer, for big white-tailed deer. We had people from all over North America, particularly the states, including Southeast, come in and hunt, and they go, how in the world did y'all, why did you get it to this stage? Well, we taught them how, and then it just started them out, increased across North America when you get right down to it, as far as age, nutrition, and genetics, and particularly age, and get them in the older age classes and make sure they got plenty to eat on a day-to-day basis.
Mm. You mentioned helicopters.
Mentioned helicopters. The helicopter was the easiest way in our part of the country to get an idea as to what the populations were as far as deer. A lot of that brush, the tallest brush there is probably 20, 30 feet at the very maximum. We were flying probably at about 40 feet, about depending upon how fast we flew is what we could see, and doing adjacent transects, counting what we saw in terms of bucks, does, and predators, and birds, and looking at the habitat, because I could learn more by getting a helicopter and spending time flying over a property, looking at how the grazing was distributed, where the water was, where there was need for in maybe some brush control, or maybe need to increase the amount of brush that's there. It gave us an overall opportunity, or an opportunity to take an overall look at a piece of property in a relatively short period of time. You can learn more in a helicopter back then. Now we've got drones, but back then just had the little Bell 47. It's like the MASH helicopters that we were in, and you can learn more in a day than you could learn in months on the ground. I get tickled because quite often I'd have an old-time rancher with me, and I'd have him fly with me so that he could see what we were seeing and kind of explain what we were looking for at the time. And we'd be flying, and he said, he takes, I've been all over this place on foot, on horseback. I know every square foot of it. Well, we'd fly over some areas where there's an old house or something like that that he had never seen, or home site that he had never seen. And his dad had grown up on that property. He'd grown up on that property. So it was one of those things, again, you could learn so very much by doing the helicopter surveys on those properties as opposed to spending a lot of time on the ground.
Man, oh my gosh, there's so many questions I could ask about this. Spending that much time in a helicopter, you got any crazy helicopter stories?
I crashed 13 times.
Oh. 13 times.
We crashed 13 times. We hit the ground really, really hard and tore up helicopters and that kind of thing. I was always very fortunate with all that. I had friends who died in helicopter crashes and friends who were paralyzed from their waist down and their neck down. But it was like being, and you know, why didn't you quit after the first one? Well, I loved it. I could learn and see so much, you know, as we were just talking about. And it was like a loud magic carpet flying over the property, too. So I just kept crawling into it. And after the 13th time, it just kind of progressively got a little bit worse. And I ended up in the hospital and all those kind of things. And after the 13th time, I said, okay, Lord, I understand. I think 13 is the magic number. We're going to cut it off right there. So I've been in a helicopter a couple of times since then in Texas, then also down in New Zealand and up in the mountains there, but no longer doing the helicopter surveys like I used to.
Man, that's crazy. I got to ask, I'm kind of going on a little side tangents here. Jacob's fighting for a question, but I'm just curious, working with, like you said, old-time ranchers back then, South Texas, who multi-generational families, do you have any good stories about any of those guys, like just unique characters or what? Were they interested in whitetails?
Back then, they were very interested in whitetails. And some of those guys had seen a decline, you know, as we talked earlier, until we got rid of the screw worms, there were deer there, but they were never in any large numbers. And kind of what happened is those deer that survived, there's plenty of food for them. I mean, there were big antlers, very few deer. And then as that population increased, they too saw the decrease in quality in terms of body weight and in terms of antler development. So yes, they were very interested to begin with. When we first started suggesting kill does, it was like, oh my God, no, you don't kill your cows, you know? And the first time when we started issuing what we used to call doe permits based on so many acres that you hope that they would harvest a doe in, kind of thing. I think we killed two does in that first year. And because they had been so protective of those animals during the time frame when they had to deal with screw worms and other things that they didn't want to lose a doe. Well, all of a sudden now we had too many. So it took a little bit of time to get some of these guys turned around to where, yes, you need to shoot does. And with me, it was always, I wanted it to be the landowner's idea when we got ready to do something. So I would plant seeds knowing that it may take 5 years to get done what I felt like needed to be done, but we'd make just small advances every year. And finally, the rancher would come to me and go, you know, I've been thinking about this. I think maybe we ought to do this, this, and this. And oh, God, that's a fabulous idea. You know, why didn't I think about that in the first place? His chest would swell out, and he'd do exactly what you'd been wanting him to do all this time. Those were the individuals who I really enjoyed working with because it was a learning experience, too, because they'd grown up on this property. They knew the property. So to me, I tried to learn as much as I could from them and then try to figure out ways that I could nudge them a little bit here, nudge them a little bit here to get them to really accomplish where they wanted to go.
I've got to ask, how did you get the nickname Mr. Whitetail?
There's a gentleman that you guys may have heard of. His name is J. Wayne Fears. J. Wayne is a writer from Alabama, grew up on Tater Knob, and a fabulous writer, one of the best writer storytellers that'll ever put words together kind of thing. But Wayne and I got to be very dear friends, and he and I were writing for different publications, but he was writing an article for a Harris publication about some of the people who hunted, spent a lot of time hunting and taking a lot of deer and their favorite firearms. And in that article, he called me Mr. Whitetail based upon my years as wildlife biologist and promoting whitetail deer and promoting habitat. And so it was J. Wayne Fears that came up with the Mr. Whitetail thing. I appeared on one of the covers and he said Mr. Whitetail's favorite, and it just kind of stuck after that, you know. So I'm very appreciative of it. I'm humbled by it because at the same time, because there are a lot of people out there that really, you know, have done as much and in some instances even more than what I have, but it's a title that I now carry whether I want to or not, but again, I'm very appreciative of it. But that's where it came from J. Wayne Fears from Alabama, who grew up in Tater Knob, Alabama.
Tater Knob. You've been around whitetails for so long. Just to give people an idea, how long have you been researching and working with whitetails?
Let's go back. I started hunting with my dad and my granddad when I was still in diapers, essentially. And when I got to be 6 years old, or even before, when I was 5 years old, my dad would put me on a deer stand by myself with a single shot 22, a Model 33 single shot, which was the first bolt action that Remington ever made, kind of thing. And so from there, I just loved the outdoors and loved hunting, and I wanted to learn about deer. And then finally, we started, you know, seeing a few deer here as well, too. When it came down to the actual research, when you started doing hard research, I started back in 1969, back when I started working with the Wildlife Disease Project. And we did lots of the early nutritional work, did some of the early genetics work as well, too, just to get a basis of things to try to figure out what deer were eating, what the value of that particular food is, why it's important to have not a seasonal diet such as we have in a lot of places where during springtime it's high percentage of digestible protein and energy, and then the wintertime it's very low, and we soon find out that the best deer come where you have pretty much a straight line of nutrition, energy, and proper minerals kind of thing. But the same thing with the wildlife disease thing is we learned that the biggest problem that we had with wildlife diseases anywhere was hollow belly, just not enough of the proper foods on a daily basis kind of thing. So it goes back to that, and about that time too, the the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department and the Kerr Wildlife Management Area back in the early 70s started doing genetic work, and we provided some of the early deer that we had there and that I caught and those kind of things. So I was able to do that, but then at the same time, too, when we were looking at nutrition, we were looking at ways, how can we improve the nutrition more so on a habitat basis rather than feeding them out of a trough kind of thing. And so it just kind of a progressive thing as you get into it. And then, you know, I wanted to see bigger antlers and I wanted to see bigger bodies and all those kind of things. Okay, how do we go about this and what can we do in this area? And each deer area is unique unto itself in terms of rainfall, in terms of soil types. And a lot of times we'd have a big piece of property where it's big enough to where you got a lot of rain on one side of the ranch, the other side you didn't get any ranch at all. This kind of vegetation here, because you had deeper soils, more rainfall here, very shallow soils here. You know, how do you manage those areas to produce the vegetation on a daily basis that those animals need, and not only the deer, but all the, you know, the songbirds and butterflies and everything as well, too.
So you've been working with whitetail deer for 57 to 58 years professionally, if I did
since
my math
1970, right. So that's whatever that's...
I did the math in my head.
56 years or something, yeah. Like that right now.
So what have you seen change for the positive with whitetails in that time frame? And have you seen anything change for the negative for whitetails at that time?
One of the things that I've seen in terms of the positive is the understanding of the importance of nutrition and allowing those animals to get a little bit of age to genetically show what they're capable of doing. The positive thing is people have started thinking a little bit more about deer on a year-round basis rather than starting in September and go, oh my, hunting season's coming on. We got to get our deer stands ready. We got to, you know, do this kind of thing. Now you're seeing a lot more people looking at it, you know, what's going on out there right now in the springtime? What's going on in the summertime? You know, have we got enough vegetation out there to protect the fawns so the coyotes and the critters can't see them as well? Is there enough food out there for those animals to eat during those time frames? That's, I think, is the positive, to have a little bit better understanding about the year-round needs of what the deer and the other wildlife is out there relative to the habitat. The negative thing is I think we have gone a little bit too far in pushing people, oh my God, you shot a 2-year-old deer? Oh my God, how horrible, you know? Well, yeah, you'd love to see a lot of us love to see those deer in those older age classes to really make them more fun to hunt, as far as I'm concerned, and make them bigger bodies and all those kind of things. But I think we put a little bit too much emphasis in some instances on inches of antlers, and to maybe even a lesser extent the age. I mean, I'm one of those, I'm not going to shoot a deer unless I know that deer's mature. You know, there's no way. I don't care what his antlers look like. I want to get him those older ages so I can truly evaluate what he might be. But I think there's a little bit too much emphasis being put on pushing people in quality sometimes, when we need to have areas too where a guy can just go out and harvest a deer, whether it's a doe, buck, whatever kind of thing. And hopefully we're starting to see a little bit of that change in some of the areas, particularly with the local war movement, with the people wanting to, you know, provide food for themselves. With the COVID thing that happened, it was a horrible thing in many ways, but COVID showed people that food comes from someplace else besides the grocery store. And it's really made people look at, maybe I ought to spend a little bit more time out there hunting and fishing and providing my own food. So there are a lot of interactions of a lot of different things there. But I think that being the case, that we're starting to see a lot more people now just going out and say, okay, I just want to harvest a deer.
What is the negative repercussions, though, that you've seen more recently with the focus on just inches versus anything else when it comes to the management side of everything for whitetails?
I think it's more of a psychological thing amongst people, is that every once in a while I try not to spend more time than I have to on social media other than to promote what I feel like I really need to promote. But somebody will show a deer and you'll see these negative, oh, I wouldn't have shot that deer. You shouldn't have shot that deer. That deer looked like he was a 2-year-old, or, you know, he was a yearling, or you should have let him, you know, he needed another 3 or 4 years before you shot him. I think that is a negative as far as I see. That, along with some of the harvest photos that are out there, have not taken time to present that animal in a respectful manner, if you will. You know, having tongues hanging out, showing blood and all those things. Yeah, all that's part of it, but we don't need to show that. I just hate seeing some of that happen that way. I'm not opposed to people showing their deer bedding because I want to see what people are taking as well too, and what areas are producing. But to me, take the time to clean that animal up, show that animal with the respect that animal should receive.
One thing that we see, and you talk about the social media, I don't want to harp on this too long, but it's interesting talking to you about because you've seen a trans, maybe how the whitetail hunting culture throughout the country, because you've been surrounded, you know, when it comes to whitetail hunting across the country and seen the different cultures and how the culture of whitetails and hunting has changed. But where people compare what would be maybe a big deer or, you know, what a mature buck should look like, say, in Illinois or Iowa compared to Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama. And the guy down there is not that good of a hunter because he's only killed 115, 120 bucks, but a lot of them are 5.5 years old or older versus the guys, you know, up in the Midwest that, you know, some of their deer can get to that potential. What is your thoughts on that just from a comparative standpoint? Because it's not great when we see it online, but how someone's dictated how good of a hunter they are just by the square, you know, just by the inches they produce versus, you know, other characteristics.
What's interesting about that is you just described several different habitats and several different food sources, and all those kind of things are going to be very dependent toward the end of what that buck's going to look like. And if a guy, like in the parts of the East Texas, if he kills a 120 buck, I mean, that deer's probably 6 years old, and by God, he's a great buck for that area, antler-wise. Well, you compare it to, such as you mentioned, in Illinois, and people are going to look at it, well, why'd they shoot that little thing, you know, kind of thing. And so I think we need to look at those kind of things a little bit more. Let's look at it from a regional basis. And what's a good deer in some parts of Texas or parts of Louisiana? I've hunted parts of Louisiana and parts of Alabama. My biggest deer in Alabama is a big 6-point that I shot. I'm as proud of it as anything that I've ever shot because of how hard I hunted to try to take that deer. And he was probably about a 4 or 5-year-old deer. But to me, you know, somebody look at that and go, well, what'd you shoot that little thing for? And so let's look, if you're going to be complimentary. If somebody's taken an animal, be complimentary of that person for taking that animal. I mean, if, as long as it was legally taken, by all means, do so. You know, build him up a little bit and say, hey, that great job. You know, we need more of those kind of things than somebody saying, well, you shouldn't be shooting that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. So over your years as a wildlife biologist, what were some of the research projects that you were the most excited about or that you look back on and you're the most happy that you were involved with?
Oh, my gosh. I've been very fortunate because I came along when we were first starting to do and people found interest in whitetail deer. Is I think more so than anything else is just being able to work with landowners and hunting groups to explain to them the importance of the habitat and then to get them to do some of that work and to manage the habitat through a variety of ways, which it may have been brush clearing, may have been planting native plants, may have been planting food plots in some instances where you just don't have the rainfall, maybe doing supplementation in terms of food, but seeing those projects come together and work and to have an understanding that the necessity of killing the number of does. And like I said, in my instance, in a lot of those places, getting those deer where you have a fair percentage of older mature bucks within a herd. All those things have been really important as far as I'm concerned when you get right down to it. Introducing kids to hunting. I started an organization back in 1985 called Texas Wildlife Association. And we very shortly thereafter formed a group called the Texas Youth Hunters. And through the Texas Youth Hunter, we've taken about 50,000 kids hunting. And in each instance, there had to be an adult, either a parent or a guardian with them. And we introduced so many different people to hunting through that way. That to me has been a very important thing. And in doing so, we explain why hunting is important, why hunting not only perpetuates but improves the habitat and improves the habitat for everything. We try to explain all those and then also the utilization of that meat that's created. All that's part of this biological thing that we do. With me, there are two different things when it comes to what we're talking about here, whether it's whitetail deer, whether it's bighorn sheep or whatever, or wolves. There's conservation and preservation. Conservation is the wise use of, takes all these scientific regimens and creates an art of, so that you produce a very high quality habitat so that all animals out there benefit from it, including the animals that we tend to be interested in, such as game species. Preservation is this very narrow, tunnel-minded look that you take, like, oh my God, we've got to save every grizzly bear. We've got to save every wolf. Well, guess what? When you start doing that, all of a sudden, the wolves have killed everything out. You know, so what have you accomplished? And in a long period of time, those wolves would starve to death. Either that or start eating liberals, you know, who've been supportive of all those kind of things. So to me, we got to look at those kind of things as part of what we're talking about. You know, what have been the great accomplishments is to making people realize there is a difference between conservation and preservation, and how important conservation is, not only to what we consider the animals that we love, because we love all of them, but I mean, I'm talking about butterflies and songbirds and skinks and, you know, reptiles and amphibians. All those, when we manage that habitat properly, all those benefit. Whereas if we try to preserve something, generally that promotes death instead of life, like conservation does. And that's part of what I'm proud of in terms of trying to make people understand.
Absolutely. Well, you explained that very, very well, too. You keep going back to habitat and nutrition, and you said that, like, speaking about white-tailed deer, for instance, where you have your biggest bucks is where the nutrition is an even keel all year long. They have high-quality nutrition all year, and it just made me curious. And let's talk southeastern states, maybe like East Texas over to Georgia, so all those states throughout there. What would high-quality food look like in the wintertime? Because I'm assuming you're not just talking about acorns and mast crops and everything.
No, you know, we've been very fortunate in the last couple of years. We've had some acorn crops in some of the areas that there were acorns still falling out of the trees in December, which is practically unheard of. To take it a step back, there over the years, there's been so much emphasis put on protein that we've overlooked the fact that energy is every bit as important to a deer in terms of fats and carbohydrates as what protein is when you get right down to it, in the presence of trace minerals of various types. In Southeast, what to me is to get that vegetation at a level to where a deer can reach it. It's like we talked about some of the areas in South Texas. We had the nutrition was really good if you were a giraffe, because that's how tall you'd have to be to eat it. And as we have changed a lot of different things, we've had the opportunity. The beauty of the Southeast is that you do have soil and you do have rainfall. So there are native plants that you can put out, but there's also food plots that you can alternate so that you have, or set up so that you have this coming up, this comes up. Okay, this starts falling away. About time this starts falling away, this comes up. And they're using different types of blends in terms of food plots. But I got tickled years ago. I'd be called to Southeast to do some stuff, and I'd go out with the landowner, and here'd be this absolutely beautiful stand of whatever it was. Usually some kind of rye. And he'd go, my God, isn't that pretty? And I said, yeah. I said, but let's look at it. We'd walk through there, and the only tracks that you could see were deer tracks walking through. You couldn't see anywhere where a deer had stopped and ate, or you couldn't see where it had been nipped off. And so we changed some of that thing in increasing all kinds of different types of legumes, and eventually the brassicas and some of the stuff when we'd started first started planting that, deer just totally left there. It took them a year or two or 3 years in some instance to figure out that what was there was really good for them. I've seen that happen numerous times in Alabama. To me, that, and we're fortunate in that some of those areas we do have our Japanese honeysuckle and things like yoke pond holly and a bunch of those that also do well with fertilization. They respond native plants. To me, one of the best browse species that we have throughout much of our areas is Smilax or greenbrier. Greenbrier is a year-round food supply for them, but it doesn't help if it's crawling up in the top of the trees and all the leaves and everything up here. So you want to go in and lower that to a level It kind of grows from what looks kind of like a hard potato when you get right down to it. But so you can cut it down to where you're getting all kinds of green growth here. That helps during the wintertime. The Japanese honeysuckle, and usually when I mention honeysuckle, they go, "Oh my God, not honeysuckle." Well, there's all kinds of honeysuckle. But the Japanese honeysuckle that we've dealt with is we've had really good success with in terms of reacting to fertilization and providing food during that hard time of the year. But there's a lot of those kind of things that can be done. In terms of plantings, you know, there's so many different things out there to plant right now, and so many different seed sources. And legumes work really well. The things that I like and that I use a fair amount is something called triticale, which is a wheat rye cross. It's actually higher in nutrition than wheat rye or oats or any of those others. It grows in a great variety of soils. It does well in wet. It does well in dry. It's very cold hardy and has a tendency to grow this way instead of grow this way. And it's really good for the animals, and it does real well. And then some of the peas, the cowpea type things, work extremely well as well, too. And a lot of those you can buy in a fancy bag if you want to with a pretty deer picture on it, or you can go to the local feed store and say, okay, what have you got that... Generally, what I've always done is I've taken a more practical approach. I'd like in say, Alabama, Georgia, Tennessee, East Texas, anywhere, I go to the farmers that are there, and I said, okay, what do you plant that you hate deer for? Because you plant it, and the deer just nearly eat it eat it up. And they go, and they'll tell me, you know, it's this, it may be a soybean, it may be it may be alfalfa, it may be a grazing alfalfa. There are all kinds of different soybeans, there's this and that. So then what I do is I go, now I know it, that grows there in those kind of soils under those kind of conditions. I know the deer like it. So that's what I'll use to use in food plots rather than buy, and then I'll lay out different strips of it as well too and try different things from that you can buy in the fancy bags. But a lot of the stuff that we plant in most areas that I've dealt with as a wildlife biologist and a hunter, we've bought at the local feed and seed store. And just go after finding out what grows there from the farmers and what the deer destroy when he plants it.
That's pretty slick. That's smart.
And what we've done in a lot of places, I used to have a bunch of country that we managed in Kentucky and parts of Tennessee and that were agricultural areas. And I would go in and find out what the yield was on a per linear foot or a per row basis kind of thing. And we'd end up buying maybe 20 rows to leave on the side, you know, where the brush was. And that made it a whole lot easier as far as the farmer was concerned, because he knew he was going to get depredation on that area right there. But then also it provided food for a longer period of time. And you don't harvest that. We just leave it until the next time you got ready to plant. So there are little things like that that can be done. But the fertilization on native browse species is pretty good. And how do you learn that? When you're out there during the wintertime, kill that deer, open that rumen up, see what he's eating. You may not know that that is a blankety blank, 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 blank scientific name, but you can look at the shape of that leaf and you go, oh, yeah, I know what that is. See how much of that you have. It's also a good way to figure out where to hunt over a natural food source. Is to, by golly, look to see what those deer are eating inside of them, you know, when you open them up, and then you go, well, I've seen that over there. Well, that may be where you want to hunt. Actually is where you want to go hunt, because that's where that food source that they're eating.
Yeah, that's a good tip too. Last year, speaking of the mast crop, we had a bumper year in Alabama. It was insane. We were killing turkeys in April that still had acorns in their craw. I mean, it was a lot.
It was an amazing year. And generally, that's kind of, it's great in a way. It made hunting really tough. Same way we had great food plots that some of the hunters that I was dealing with are hunting on. And they go, man, we're not seeing any deer. And I said, have you been in the woods? No, I haven't been in the woods. You know, they always come to the food plots this time of the year. Well, I walked in the woods and guess what? We were spooking deer all over the place. And finally got some of them off those food plots into the woods and just hunting off the ground, just setting up natural ground blinds. And they finally started killing some deer that way.
Yeah, we have a theory that we've been talking about this year. Our buddies, we all kind of share this theory. So we had such a mast crop last year. The deer were fat all year long. Even Even the buck, I killed a buck in Alabama this year, kind of later in the rut, and he looked good. Like, he did not look run down. And our theory is that when they come out of the rut this year, they're so fat and healthy that this coming fall, the antlers and the body weight should be higher. So you agree?
I totally agree. The nutrition time that's so very important on mature bucks or all bucks or anything is coming out of that rut, because, you know, whitetail buck will, if he's and usually it's like the 3- and 4-year-old deer and 2-year-old deer, and occasionally you'll find some of the older deer that get run down. They may lose 30% of their body weight. And if they can't, I've actually seen, we had some bucks that I was able to trace through the years because they were missing an ear or they had a white spot or something like that. And we had lots of deer that I looked at that at when they were 3-year-old deer, they were 150-plus deer. They came back at a 4-year-old deer, and they're the prettiest 128-point you've ever seen in your life. And it was the same deer, and they'd gotten so run down they could not repair. But this year, as you mentioned, and again, going back to how important energy is, mm-hmm. that energy, that those fats and carbohydrates is so very important, particularly in that coming out of that rut in the late wintertime and in the shape those deer were in that you described and a lot of other places, there will be some unbelievably outstanding antlers this year. Man, no question. We're already seeing it in some of the areas that I've looked at. I mean, they're up about yay big, but they're this big around as compared to, you know, be fairly small in diameter or in circumference. So I'm expecting some unbelievable deer in a lot of places, bigger deer than most people have seen in a long time, particularly if they got a little bit of age on them.
So the year before last, so not this past season, but the year before that, we had a very, very bad drought in the summer that we had almost no mast that year. And this past season, there was a lot of guys talking about how they felt like the bucks they were tracking year to year didn't really blow up. Like, a lot of deer they were watching were like, oh, you know, next year's going to be their year. And they just really didn't put that much on. So if that was the case last year, then they had a really good year this year. Can they fully rebound? Does Absolutely. It just take 1 year?
Absolutely. They can rebound like you can't believe. I'm going talking about where I've seen them go to 120, and they don't chase as hard, and there's an adequate food supply. The next year, they'll be as big or bigger than they were the year before. But I've seen numerous bucks go from typical 10s with kickers and mass and all that kind of stuff go to a root one, and all nutrition-wise, and year because they chased so hard, they couldn't recover, and maybe they were the same situation we talked about here because you had a severe drought, you didn't have the food. Well, thankfully they survived, but that following year when they get back, I mean, I've seen them blossom like you can't believe, and I really feel like that's going to happen in a lot of those areas.
Now, another interesting thought that I've heard from some other individuals is, and you just mentioned this with some of your hunters and some places you're helping managing, they weren't seeing many deer in their food plots, and they weren't going to the woods. And presumably, if you didn't tell them to get off in there and kind of show them some stuff, they probably wouldn't have killed very many deer. And I've heard from some people that was a good thing, because that was pretty common across most Southeast. Harvest numbers were down, to get bucks another year going into this season. So what is your thoughts on that from...
Absolutely. You just nailed it when you said that right there, is because it got a lot of deer across North America from being a 3-year-old to a 4- or 5-year-old deer this year. And so you've got that added age into everything as well, too. And the interesting thing is, like most of our southern deer, they will bodily mature at about 4 years of age. That's when all the long bones are grown. So after that, anything that's not required for maintenance can be channeled into antler development. In the far north country, they usually mature full body at 3.5-year-old deer. I've shot deer in Canada that were Boone and Crockett quality, you know, and they were 3-year-old deer kind of thing. But they matured quicker in those areas. But getting those deer, because of the lower harvest rate, percentage, whatever you want to call it. In a lot of the areas that we had this year, these deer, they're a year older. They're going to be a year bigger body-wise. They've come through the rut because of the nutrition that they've had, particularly in terms of energy and then the boost of protein and all those other things that come along with early spring. So they're going to be a year older and a much bigger but they're also a year older, and they're going to be a little bit harder to hunt. I've seen so many deer that I've dealt with over the years, individual bucks that I could track, that until the time they were 3.5 years of age, they were just big doofuses. I mean, they'd show up anywhere. And it looked like as they started into that antler cycle of their fourth year, they'd walk up to a pond and, or some water source and look, and all of a sudden, they see they got a bigger set of antlers, and all of a sudden, they're doing this. They're backing up. They become much more nocturnal. They're much more skittish or more wary than they were prior going into that. And I've seen the same thing happen. We had a pet buck that we called Ricky on a property that I used to take care of in the hill country. And Ricky was an 8-point as a yearling. As a 2-year-old, he was a really nice 9-point, and then a 3-year-old. And you saw him everywhere. And this place was high fence. It was like 2,000 acres, high fence. And you would see him from stands all over that property, particularly during the rut. And he grew up eating Dorito chips, bananas, and Purina dog chow. The rancher's wife would put out stuff for him every time, all the time. Well, when he got to be 4 years old, Ricky was a 150, 160 class deer, and the rancher's wife came to me and she said, "Larry, you will not allow anybody to kill that deer this year." And I'm going, you know, what am I going to do? So he was coming on. He was growing really good. So I caught him, shaved the hair off of each side of his body, put a big no on both sides, put two big pendulum ear tags in his ears, so he would be very visible. Okay, there's no excuse that you shot this deer not knowing what it was, kind of thing. Well, guess what? That fourth year, nobody saw Ricky other than at night. And Ricky, they lived on a little bit of a creek hill above a creek, had a nightlight there. And Ricky would show up there an hour after dark. He'd go eat his bananas and his Dorito chips, create a dog chow, chase does right there, lay down. An hour before daylight, Ricky would disappear. Nobody would see Ricky. This happened every year. He would do that starting about October the 2nd until about January the 15th. Nobody saw this deer during daylight hours with all the hunting that was going on. And we had trail cameras out as well, too. That deer was not seen. Since about the time the testosterone started greatly decreasing, Ricky'd be showing up everywhere. Come back next year, great big old set of antlers, two big ear tags, deer, no on the freeze branded on the side, so it showed up as white, you know, kind of thing. And same thing would happen again about the first part of October. Ricky would go, you wouldn't see him, except at night. He'd come by an hour after dark, stay there all night long, chase those, because there were does there as well, too, or lay underneath the nightlight, eating his bananas and his Dorito chips and bringing a dog chow. Hour before daylight, he'd be gone, you know. So that deer had no reason in the world to be afraid of anything. He'd grown up around people. Had grown up in the rancher's house, actually. That was just a very natural, innate thing that he did.
I think I just learned the best supplemental feed you can do is Doritos, bananas, and bring a dog chow to grow a big deer. That's what I just learned from that story.
I got to know what happened to old Ricky. Whatever happened to him?
I have no idea. I was there until he was 7 years of age, and then they ended up selling the ranch. And I suspect he probably either died of natural causes, because I did not hear of anybody. I had some people that worked on the ranch, and they never mentioned the fact that he was killed. So he probably just ended up dying of natural causes, probably the same thing.
Wow.
But he would just flat during that time frame turn totally nocturnal.
So another aspect of the conversation about the heavy mass crop, deer making another year because they weren't being killed, they weren't going to bait piles or, you know, supplemental feed stations or food plots. Also on the flip side, how does that affect the doe population expanding as well? Because, again, looking at some of the harvest records I saw, harvest numbers, even doe harvest was down. What does that mean for landowners and managers going into this coming
season? Coming into this year, it means you're going to have to get really high behind and take the number of does that need to come off that property, recommended by whoever you're working with, or just if you're seeing a lot of deer, spend a lot of time shooting does. Fawn survival rate's going to be really good this year, too. And that population can get out of hand so very, very quickly. And, you know, we've talked about having a drought in a really good year. You manage that deer herd for the worst of years, not the best of years. So you want to bring that population back down. So this will be a year, as far as I'm concerned, you really need to hit those does, hit them hard, hit them early. And, frankly, you probably can't take too many of them, because as you decrease that doe population, your fawn survival rate's going to go up as well, too. So you'll be right back in the business. Sometimes you can end up with more bucks by killing does than if you didn't.
Interesting.
Is there a reason why fawn survival goes up when you lower the doe population?
I think it's just a natural occurrence of Mother Nature to try to perpetuate that particular species kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting over the years, I try to keep up on places that I get a chance to hunt regularly, try to keep up with looking at fawns, and particularly as we go into the fall. And for the last numerous years, now normally bucks and does are bonded about a 50-50 ratio kind of thing, but on so many places that I've dealt with, we've seen as high as 65% to 70% of the fawns that we kept, that we could see, that we keep record of, were bucks. So we really, and then in those same properties, this has been going on for several years now, we've seen that, you've seen it in the bucks in terms of yearlings, two-year-old, three-year-old, four-year-olds kind of thing as well, too. So there's something been going on in a lot of places where we've produced more buck fawns than we do doe fawns. Now, there's research that was done many, many years ago on some of the German deer, in turn, like roe deer and red stag and those kind of things. And they've said that in those areas where you had that doe on a somewhat stressed basis going into the fall, into the breeding season, that year she had a tendency, when she got bred, to produce more buck fawns that following year. And when that everything was great and there was so much nutrition there, there was a tendency to produce more doe fawns to take advantage of that food. Now, that's something that's happened there. I've seen some of that happen in Texas and other places, but the last several years where I've really paid attention to the number of buck fawns compared to doe fawns, it hadn't really been the case, because some of these places have been on a really good nutritional basis on a daily basis kind of thing as well, too. So I'm not sure what's going on there. I just know what I've seen.
How do you determine how many does you should shoot off your property or your club or whatever?
What I've always done, it kind of depends. First of all, you go back to the habitat, you know, and what can that country support in the worst of years, not the best of years. And then we try to shoot where we can for a buck to doe ratio of 1:2 to 1:1.5. In a natural, I've been fortunate over the years, when we're talking about helicopter stuff, to fly over some areas where there was no hunting. I mean, big ranches, to where we're talking about 200,000 acres, and you go into the interior of that, maybe 50,000 acres of it, and the natural buck to doe ratio there year after year is 1 buck to every 1.5 does. So I look at that, trying to utilize that, but then look at what the total deer density is in terms of adult density, what the and total density is as far as increased the fawn survival rate that you had and what your increase is. And so I'll try to come up with a number that I feel like that property can support in terms of adult deer. And then based on that, that's what we're going to try to keep that number pretty close to that as much as we can in terms of recommending what buck-to-doe ratios, based on buck-to-doe ratio and density in terms of does and bucks that need to come off there every year.
So if guys are just like running trail cameras on food plots or whatever, is that a good way to gauge your buck to doe ratio?
That's one way to do it, and it's certainly I'm not going to say it's the best way. It's, to me, the best thing that you can do is when you're out on the property, just keep a tab of everything that you see in terms of bucks, does, and fawns. Every time you go out and look at it, every time you're out there, trail cameras, same thing. You know, take that data and transpose it into that kind of thing. And I don't care if you see the same animals every day, you're going to get a pretty good idea as to what your number of bucks, not numbers so much, but the bucks and the does, and you can get an idea as to what your buck to doe ratio is that way. Same thing with fawn survival rate. You know, take the trail camera pictures, look at the fawns, but every time you're out there and while you're hunting, just keep a running tab of the bucks you see, the does you see, and you'll come up with a pretty good idea as to what your buck-doe ratio is over a longer period of time. Because early on, you may see very few does or very few bucks, and then all of a sudden, and in most instances, it's been my experience. I've gone to places where they tell us, man, we got a buck-to-doe ratio of 1 to 20. There are 20 does out here for every one of them. Well, when I've kept them, got them to keep incidental observations, it was probably closer to more to 1 to 4 to 1 to 5 than 1 to 20, you know, kind of thing. And they go, oh my God. And you start looking at the data, they go, I can't believe this. And I said, well, you're the one who recorded the data, you know? Did you lie?
Just about to ask about that. I was just about to ask, because you hear that all the time about like 1 to 15, 1 to 10. And I was just curious, like, is it even possible for a wild herd to get that out of whack?
It is. Back when Alabama had a one deer a day bag limit, I got to look at a bunch of country in different parts of Alabama. And yeah, there were probably, you know, we took incidental observations utilizing the people who were on the plantation every day working. And I had those guys keeping record. And there were several places where when we did that over a period starting in about, as soon as you could tell the difference between bucks and does, when they started growing antlers and fawns, you know, until the time they dropped, we looked at that. And it would be that skewered in some instances, because a lot of guys back then, it wasn't about, you know, I want to kill a buck a day. Well, can you utilize a buck today? Not really, you know, from a food perspective kind of thing. So once that changed, a lot of that went from that 1 to 10, probably 1 to 8, 1 to 10, probably was probably a good average somewhere along and through there, to maybe 1 to 3, 1 to 4.
Let me ask you this, from all your research and just working with whitetails over length of time, what is one of the more interesting facts you've learned about whitetails that you didn't previously know, but you learned through research or through other biologists? That was
one of the things that we've learned over the years, being able to watch individual bucks, again, going to maybe there's some marking on them that's very similar. Before, watching how far some of those deer move at times. We've had some bucks that I watched that would move, spend all their time until the middle of October, and then move to where they're going to spend the time during the breeding season, move as far as 12 miles. That's one thing that I've seen several times. The other thing is we've always said that deer have their best antlers at like 5 or 6 years of age. Well, I've been able to watch a lot of different bucks over the years, and certain bucks have had specific antler style, and I wanted those bucks to see what they would grow into. Those bucks would go to like 6, 7, 8, and they'd go like this, and they'd level off at about 9, and then all of a sudden 10, and then 11, if they lived to be 11, 12, or 13, they'd put on 50, 60, 70 inches of antler. I'm not talking about spread, I'm talking about points. So some of those bucks, not all of them, but there's a certain number of bucks out there, a certain percentage, whatever that is, that if given the opportunity to get in those older, really old, ancient age classes, under the presence of good nutrition, because they got to have the feed that's soft enough to where, you know, they can still chew it. But it's amazing what some of those bucks will put on in those extreme older age classes. And to me, that's been one of the really fun things to watch.
Wow. Okay.
You can't manage for those. You can't manage for 12 or 13 year old deer.
Yeah.
You know, but if you have that one or two that kind of slips away, or you might just say, okay, we're just going to not, if we can. And a lot of times it's not bucks that you say, well, I've seen them all the time. It's just all of a sudden you shot one of the oldest bucks I've ever shot by centum aging was like 13 and a half. And it was in a really bad drought the year, but he still scored in the low 160s and had 3 drop times on site. And I'd hunted that deer every year for year after year after year. Just I'd never would see him during the – we'd see him, the rancher, the cowboys would see him, and I'd go hunt him. And I never saw him until that last year. But, I mean, he had markings on his shoulder, so I knew it was that same buck.
What's the oldest deer that you know of that someone's killed?
The oldest deer that I know of was a pet doe that was 19 years of age. She lived on a friend of mine's place. He got her, he was given to him from the people that raised her when she was a 2-year-old deer. We called her, I'll think of her name here in just a little bit, a special name. But she was a deer that she's one of these does, had a huge bag. I mean, she produced a lot of milk. The interesting thing about that doe was, is that she lived to be 19 years of age. He had her like 17 years. Out of those 17 years, every year Glory would come up to their house, have her fawns in their backyard. So we had the opportunity, I was able to get special permits so we could put ear tags or mark these deer in certain ways. And we marked the bucks, we didn't mark the does. And over the years, we know that Glory produced 12 Boone and Crockett bucks that we know of because they were shot. Now, there were probably others that she produced that didn't survive or whatever that had that potential, but we know that she, and so she wasn't bred to the same deer every year, obviously. Mm-hmm. She was just one of those does that carried a strong genetic fur antlers, but also was a really good mama in that those fawns, from the time they were born, they were healthy. She was producing a lot of milk, but we know there were 12 Boone and Crockett bucks that she produced over those years. Wow. So 19 years old, there was supplemental feed there, of course, later on, but so I know that she lived that long.
And you said was there something physical about her? Like she had a big back?
Big bag. I'm talking about a big udder.
Oh, okay.
So she was producing a lot of milk. She wasn't an overly big deer. She was kind of stockily built, you know, but she was just one of those does that was a really good mama and didn't make a bit of difference. Similarly, which buck she was bred to, she was going to produce just ungodly big antlers.
Can you talk a little bit about the genetics and genetic passing on of genes from bucks with bucks and does? Because again, everybody, and I'd love for you to elaborate on this, but everybody thinks like a big buck's going to produce a big buck fawn, okay? I just love for you just to kind of elaborate on some of that.
With all the pen deer that we have, these deer, we've genetically engineered these deer to where we've line bred them so much. That's one thing. In a real world situation, both the bucks and does bring genetics to that, what that buck's going to look like. The doe probably has a little bit more influence, maybe in some instances genetically. You can't really prove it, and can in some respects, and some you can't. But that doe is the one that's nursing that fawn, and she's going to teach that fawn how to survive, and she's going to teach that fawn what to eat, what's good to eat, and what's not good to eat. So from an environmental perspective, that becomes really, really important kind of thing. In so many different ways. But as far as the genetic side of it, there's some say that the doe probably brings a little bit more as far as main beam length and maybe a little bit more mass, and the buck brings in the points, and, you know, but there's really nothing that's there. What's really interesting is there was a study done on the Comanche Ranch, which is a huge ranch in South Texas right along the Texas border, to where they have gone in over the years and caught so many of the deer and done genetics. So they have got DNA on thousands of deer that they've caught. And what's really been interesting is they've produced numerous Boone and Crocketts every year. I mean, huge antlers. And when they start tracing back some of these, where these really big bucks came from, well, they didn't come from a really big antlered buck. They came from that particular line, one of the best breeders that they've had in terms of producing known huge antlered bucks was a whitetail buck that never scored above 135. I mean, they've caught him, they've watched him, they had it, but he carried genetics, and as did the doe, which are does he bred to, for producing big antlers. But that individual buck that never scored more than 135, and most people would have culled him, you know, on an intensive management program, that buck produced more Boone and Crockett bucks, sired more Boone and Crockett bucks than any other buck they had on the property. And again, this is from taking in consideration thousands and thousands of DNA samples that they were able to utilize with helicopters and everything else catching these deer. So basically they've got, you know, in a roundabout way, they've got almost a certified genetic herd there, knowing, you know, if deer gets killed or if they gets caught, you know, they can go trace back to find out, okay, that note up, that, okay, she goes back to this buck. And I mean, it's amazing what they've been able to come up with. But the fact that this deer that would have been culled on a lot of places produced more Boone and Crockett bucks than any of the rest of them really makes you take note about it, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Well, and it brings up something that we hear a lot about in Alabama and different parts of the Southeast, where landowner has maybe an interesting antler characteristic that is undesirable, okay? One that's real common, we talked to biologists about this, which is and it's the difference between pedicle damage compared to potentially Gen X, but the one just straight beam or spike on one side and a big 4 or 5 point side on the other, and there's a wide variety of bucks on a property that has that characteristic. And Dr. Ditchkoff, Steve Ditchkoff down at Auburn University, he said he's only found one place where the, based off genetic study in Alabama, that they actually proved that it was a genetic, not just a antler pedicle damage.
Right.
Is there anything that you've ever seen with clients or anybody you've ever worked with or heard of where they've been able, without introducing deer to the property, talking like high fence bringing deer in and releasing them, being able to change antler characteristics from an intense management program?
Yeah, we've done some of that to where we've gone into some of these properties that were relatively large where we could work in the interior more so than anything else. And occasionally there was a high fence. Mm-hmm. And where we went in, and for the first 3 years, we killed every buck whose antlers we didn't like. Shot a few does. Didn't really kill a whole lot of does. And then that fourth year went in and shot every doe that we thought was older than 3 years of age. So the theory being that those does that were there were sired by some of the better antlered bucks that we had kind of genetically engineered kind of thing. The result of that was is it made a tremendous amount of difference. We saw a tremendous jump in antlers as those fawns started from those started getting some age on them. Made a lot, lots and lots of difference kind of thing. We had a piece of property that we had a lot of mature 6 points on. And I hunted, there was one area that this, just every deer, it seemed like every buck we saw was a 6 point. Well, we shot as many as we could, but they're all relatively young. And so I felt like there were a couple of older bucks, and I finally shot one of the older bucks, and then occasionally we're still seeing big 6 points. And I finally ended up, long story, but I finally figured out, I found shed antlers, and so I got up one morning, got up one night at 1 o'clock, walked into this thicket where this deer, I thought, probably bedded up. And he was kind of the patriarch of that area. And strong north wind, and about 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm sitting there freezing my butt off, but in this thicket is where I'd found these sheds. This buck comes in, and he walks and lays down about from distance that we're apart right here, about 10, 15 feet away, facing into the wind, and I'm on the back side of him. And finally it gets light enough and legal shooting time gets there, and it's a big old 6 point. I mean, he's like 6, 7, 8 years old, and I shoot him. And so when we did that, then I went back into that same area and I shot every doe in that area that we could, that I could legally get permits to do. And it kind of created a vacuum. And at the same time, all these deer from around who had were from different animals started showing up. And we kind of did away with that 6 point gene that was there. So those kind of things you can do. The thing, and when it comes to genetics in terms of bringing deer in, I get tickled a lot of people. Well, we're going to bring in bucks from so-and-so. Well, if you got native deer, chances are when you bring those bucks in, those native bucks are going to kill them to start with. And if you've got a halfway decent number of bucks and does in the area, the chance of that buck breeding more than one doe are very, very slim. You don't accomplish anything. And what we were able to do years ago and using South Texas places is we'd go in and catch bred does. And when you do that, if you're going to try to manipulate the genetics, you're much better off going in there and bringing in bred does. Because the fawns that are born there, the does are not going to be messed with like the bucks are. The fawns are going to be born there. They're going to figure out what to eat. And that's where you start seeing if you want to play that game. Although to me, so very often I've seen people go in and kill out a deer herd and bring in genetics. And truth be known, they probably killed better deer than what they brought in when you got right down to it. They just hadn't given that animal the opportunity, those deer to mature, those bucks to mature in the presence of good nutrition on that, again, that straight line basis rather than the seasonal basis. So, you know, to me, the better thing to do is to improve the habitat. You know, if you don't like a buck, yeah, go ahead and shoot him if they really want to. Or spikes, you know, I mean, there's a big issue. The one thing I can tell you about spikes, I can guarantee you this. If you kill that buck as a spike as a yearling, he ain't going to get any bigger. That's the one thing. I've seen years ago, we were doing some nutrition and genetic research on a piece of property that I had access to. The best bucks that were turned into the bigger antlered bucks in the future were the bucks that had 3 to 5 points. On that, that's how that genetics in that area worked. By the time they were 5 years old, a lot of, they were 140 plus deer, and there were some 160s and one other kind of deer, and there were a few 130s as well too. But the vast majority of those had were that 3 to 5 point. On the spike thing, as you really increase the nutrition, what happens is there, among other things, you can create spikes because the white-tailed does, when they're 6 months of age, they're sexually mature. Well, guess what? If a white-tailed doe comes into heat and say your rut's in November, those bucks are going to have viable sperm until February. Okay, she comes into heat in late January, February, I promise you she's going to get bred. And she's like a 6-month-old heifer or cow trying to grow body and trying to grow offspring and all that. I promise you, when that happens, she gets bred at 6-month-old. She has a late fawn. That fawn is going to be a spike that first year. Genetically, he may be strong, but it will take him a long time to get caught up. And we've had places where we really increased the nutrition, and we've had as high as 70% of our 6-month-old doe fawns get bred. And so, the first time we did that years and years ago, we started seeing all these spikes. What in the heck is going on? I thought it didn't take long to try to figure out what it was. And then we started shooting a lot of 6-month-old doe fawns too. Because you look at how the Europeans have been doing things, and I look at that. I've been fortunate to spend time in Europe and visit with biologists. And here we've been doing some of this stuff now for intensive management, when you get right down to it, probably 60 years or so. Well, they've been doing it for 600. And so to me, you can learn a lot from what they've been able to accomplish and how they do that. And they shoot a certain number of young does as well, too, not just, just all throughout the different age classes. It makes a difference.
Man, okay, now we're fighting over questions again.
I brought that up about shooting does, or if you could – I was bringing up the whole aspect of, can you change through a wild deer herd, change antler characteristics by harvest? Because there's a gentleman in a Midwest state, won't say where, because I want to interview the guy. But anyways, he talks about it, and he's done it on different farms, and he's the only person we've ever heard talk about doing it. But getting a ton of tags and going in there and just – and what he likes to do is go in and specifically – knock out as many does as he legally can and bring other hunters in to draw other deer, other does in from different areas and to see what they produce.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And the thing about it is it's like family groups when you get right down to it. There, even though it's not hybrid vigor, there is some of that because you're bringing totally different groups together. I mean, they're all white-tailed deer. But there's something to be said about some of that. But we were able to do that over a period, and we've done that on several places where we went in and start with just shot the daylights out of the bucks. I didn't care if we had 3 bucks left on the entire property because I wanted to just, and I was shooting particularly mature bucks, and it made a tremendous amount of difference. It takes time, and most of us, in today's world, it's an immediate thing. I want it now. I don't want to wait 5 years from now. I don't want to, I'm not going to wait that long. But if people have patience, it's amazing what can be done with the natural genetics that's there. And a lot of times, as I mentioned, it's a lot better than what they might be able to bring in.
And also, just to clarify for audience members, you're talking about you're going in and taking out as many of those bucks as you legally can get permits for. But then after a certain point, they're then going and taking out does from that same general area.
Yeah, and again, you take it comes down to hoping that the bucks that you left have the tendency to produce offspring with bigger antlers. So they have sired does fawns who now carry those kind of genes. And then we'd go in and, like I said, and then we'd try to shoot after 3 years, then the fourth year, we'd go in and try to shoot every doe that we could. And we were able to get special permits and all those kind of things. These were Texas places. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So where we couldn't get the permits, we would set up management programs under research projects so we could afford to do that legally. But it made a tremendous amount of difference on these places.
That is fascinating. So is there any rhyme or reason? So you're trying to shoot – when you're trying to take those bucks out with the undesirable antler characteristics, you're trying to shoot your older deer. You're not trying to shoot the 1 and 2 year olds. Are you shooting them at 3, or are you trying to let them get even older than that?
Well, in those situations, to start with, we were shooting them at 3. I mean, if he was 3 year old or older, if he didn't have 10 points, or he didn't have brow tines, or he had short tines relative to that area, I mean, not going, well, he's not, doesn't score 180, so we're going to kill him kind of thing. So that's what we were doing there, though. Then when we got a little bit in further into the program, then I wanted to start on those people. They had the money where we could afford to do it. They only needed to take a certain number of deer off of each year for their family kind of thing. And these places were a lot of times were family places rather than trying to do commercial hunts. When you're doing commercial hunts, it's a totally different kind of game. But with doing it that way, once we got that population, like, it'd be like a 7 year period. Year 7 is when we started. That's when we started looking a little bit closer at, okay, we're going to let really want to get these deer up into like the 6, 7 year old age classes.
Now, with the does, is there any rhyme or reason to which does you're trying to kill out?
When you need to shoot does, it's the one that you can put an arrow into, a bolt into, put the crosshairs on long enough to pull the trigger. When you need to shoot does, don't be, shoot. And shoot and shoot some more.
So long as you legally, or whatever.
Yeah, just don't worry about what if you got you need to take a bunch of does, don't worry so much about what age they are or what size they are or whatever. And it doesn't hurt to you don't want to shoot a 6 month old buck fawn. But again, it doesn't hurt to shoot some of the 6 month old doe fawns either.
Okay.
Meat's really tender. Yeah, you don't get quite as much, but oh my God, is it tender?
It's good. Man, that's awesome. I'm glad we got to talk about that, because that's been a question. We've been talking about it for a couple months now, where we wanted to interview a couple different guys with a biology background on that subject, because you've heard it go back and forth on culling a lot over the years, whether it works or doesn't
work.
Well,
on the culling of the bucks, it's really interesting. I mentioned 8 points a while ago, and I mentioned I've seen some of these bucks go from great big to really pretty 8 point. You know, in a lot of places, particularly here in Texas, we're going to shoot every 8 point buck, older 8 point buck that we see. Well, when you do that, you're going to shoot a lot of those 4-year-old deer that at 3-year-old deer were 140, 150 in that following year because they got run down because they chased so hard, even though there was a lot of nutrition there, they chased so hard that following year they just can't grow the antlers like they had previously. So it's really pretty 110, 120, 8 point. And everything else that's out there has got a little older or even 3-year-old, they're going to be 130s or whatever. You shoot those, and when you do that, you're removing some of those bucks that the following year would go right back to being 140 or better bucks.
Mm-hmm. One other thing you mentioned earlier, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this, is the idea that a buck can become nocturnal. Could you elaborate a little bit more on that? On like, what do you classify as a buck being nocturnal?
Going back to some of the properties that I've managed, where we were able to get numerous bucks into the 4 year or older age class. Again, going back before we had trail cameras, I'd suggest these hunters that were hunting there said, "I want you to shoot 4 year old deer." They'd hunt their butts off hunting, but I'll come back to that. How they hunted? They hunted their butts off. And they come to me and says, "You're lying. We don't have any 4 year old age. I don't know what happened. They're not here. There are no older deer here." So I'd call the local game warden and I'd say, "Hey, meet me tonight at about midnight at such and such a place. We're going to take these guys out and show them some deer." So the warden would show up just because we're good friends, but it was the proper thing to do anyway. And we'd go out and we'd show these guys deer that they had no idea that were on their property. You could find them between the hours of about 12 at night and 3 o'clock in the morning, kind of like you do very similarly a lot of times with trail cameras. Now, there's been research that shows supposedly very recently that moon phase and none of these other things have anything to do, that deer die early, they move in the morning, they move in the afternoon. Well, about 70 years of hunting experience and 50 years of that as a professional wildlife biologist, that's BS. The biggest deer that I've seen, they're talking about whitetail bucks, the biggest deer that I've killed, with the exception of maybe one or two of them, I've shot between the hours of 10 o'clock in the morning and 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And I've put a lot of hunters out. And those bucks that I was discussing earlier that I could show those guys at midnight and 3 o'clock in the morning, I'd be out while they're in the camp eating, taking naps, cussing the fact that they hadn't seen anything. And I'd be out and I'd see all kinds of really good deer during that midday time. And particularly during those time frames when there was virtually no moon at night or there was a full moon at night. Those two times to me is when you really want to hunt all day long. And I do every opportunity I can. There's sometimes I can't. But I have taken more big, older mature bucks and have had hunters that hunted the properties that we managed take those kind of bucks during that middle of the daytime than any other time. And that, to me, is when those nocturnal bucks move. I think it's somewhat a natural thing that they do. And then deer are pretty smart. In fact, that we have taught them that most hunters hunt from daylight till about 9:30, 10 o'clock, go to the house, have breakfast, and they go back out about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And they've seen it happen. They can hear the ATVs running back and forth, you know, and I think we have taught those deer to a lot of extent in certain areas that that's when we hunt. Well, they know the best time to move then is during time frame when nobody's in the woods.
So on the topic of nocturnal, I want to kind of get even a little bit more in the weeds on it. When you say a buck's nocturnal, to the average guy who's hunting, is it that he's just not shown up where the guy's typically hunting and he's moving around other places, or that he's truly laying down majority?
It's both.
Okay.
It's both in those instances. You have to be at the right place at the right time, obviously, regardless. And that deer may or may not be moving around in that area, you know. And that's where trail cameras sometimes become so deceiving, is that you've seen him, and then where'd he go, you know? Well, he's probably 300 yards away from where you're sitting. You know, he may be moving, kind of thing. So I don't pay a whole lot of attention to the trail camera. I love to look at deer and get an idea. I can get an idea what kind of deer it has antler-wise and age and, you know, all these other kind of things. But yes, maybe at the right place or wrong time, wrong place at the right time kind of thing. But chances are that deer is probably moving during that middle time of the day. Now, deer are as individual as you and I are. And some deer will move at certain times. Certain deer like to eat certain things. Certain deer don't like certain areas. And they don't like, some of them deer don't like being around other deer, you know, and all those kind of things. And so very often it's some of those really big mature bucks, the ones that don't like being around other deer. You hear so much about the dominant buck. A dominant buck is one of two deer, either this big bully 8-point or this little scrawny runt that likes to fight. The really big bucks with big antlers, a lot of times they're not the dominant, quote unquote, buck in the area. If they're the dominant buck there, it's because they're the only buck in that part of the country. Because I've seen too many times just those dominant 8-points or older eight points or just scrappy little bucks that like to fight, and those bigger antler bucks, they'll just walk away. They don't want to have anything to do with them.
Now, what is your thought on the moon in particular? Like moon phase?
On the moon phase?
Oh, yeah.
Years and years of hunting experience and being out all hours of the day and night, you know, those kind of things. There's something there. I've seen it way too many times to where in off seasons or whatever, I'll be driving around and there's tremendous deer movement at a certain period of time during the time frame. And I'll make note of it. And I've done this numerous times all over North America, actually. And then gone back and say, okay, what did the activity chart say? You know, and then prior to that and after that time frame, there was very little movement, including late in the afternoon, early in the morning. And it may be at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It may be at 9 o'clock that they start moving. There is a definite correlation between moon phase and their kickers in the deal, weather, temperature, food, rut going on. All these things come into play, but In a utopian world, from what I've seen of white-tailed deer, they follow the moon phase and activity charts very closely.
You know, that's interesting because, again, that's another thing that I feel like science biologists have gone back and forth on for years and years. And you've got some people who are diehard about it and some people who aren't. Yeah. And there's even studies like GPS studies where they're like, well, this doesn't show anything, but I always wonder about their methodology or how they're looking at the data. They're just not quite seeing it. Like it's might be there, but they're measuring it incorrectly or something. What's your take on that?
I could take data and show it to do whatever I wanted to, quite frankly, you know, when it comes right down to it. And again, you'll see a study like that and it's done in a specific area. Well, you don't know all the other circumstances that are occurring with that deer herd there. You know, maybe there's no reason for them to move other than during these time frames kind of thing. But you go over 10 miles and it to another place, and that deer herd's totally different from the one. So to me, some of our research projects that are done are so localized, and we put so much faith in them, that they're true for that area, but it doesn't mean that they're true for 20 miles away, 5 miles away. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just like here in Texas. We have periods of rut in Texas. Mm-hmm. They start in August. There's an area down close along the coast between Victoria and Corpus where the rut's going on in August. You don't have to go very far to the west, and the rut doesn't occur until the middle part of December. You know, they're all white-tailed deer. They're all at the same latitude. And, you know, you'd think they were the same, but they're not. And then they're family groups. I mean, you have these little genetic strains that develop in certain areas kind of thing, so they can be totally different than any place else around. People were the same way. You know, now being from Alabama and having spent time in Alabama, I've spent time around some of those areas where those folks that live there, they spent their entire time there, except for maybe when the guys had to go to the Army or something like that. You know, and they do things a certain way.
This is another rabbit hole just on genetics. I'm real interested.
Okay.
When it comes to white-tailed deer, and you're talking about different characteristics from different areas and populations, I've heard someone talk about this, and I've never really read into it in super detail, but talking about different if you call it substrains, but specific characteristics of whitetails from very specific areas that are very unique, okay? And brings up like kind of the whole aspect of potentially different, I don't know if it'd be a true subspecies, but different varieties of whitetail. Have you seen anything like
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely. I've worked a lot of different check stations over the years, and I could tell you generally when I looked at the antler style, about with probably at least 75, if not to 90% certainty, I could tell you what part of the county that deer came from because of how the antlers were, within certain parameters kind of thing. So, yeah, and it comes back down to that kind of the family type of thing when you get right down to it. But, yeah, there's definite areas in East Texas that we used to work. Well, I could tell you almost exactly where that deer came from because there were certain areas where the antlers were all pretty much straight up, you know, and then another one had kickers on maybe on one side, or some of them were wider, some of them were more massive. And you saw more of those kind of deer from that area, you know. So, I mean, there's a lot of genetic variability. You can have a really wide buck where the trees are this far apart, but generally not. You know, they're going to be more compact kind of thing. There's some areas in East Texas I used to look at, and these antlers were 6-inch bases, gnarly, chocolate brown, I mean, just gorgeous, and they'd be about a 14-inch spread. But their tines would be this long, you know, and just really massive. And it was in an area where traditionally there had been really, really thick woods. Because you start thinking about it, you know, a 20-inch buck where most of the trees are 23, 24 inches apart, he can't go through there very easily. So those deer have a tendency to not survive over a period of time. So you create this little natural creation of a genetic strain that is adapted to this particular area.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that. We've been theorizing about that forever because there's places in Alabama like that, places that we hunt where it's tight rack bucks and it's pine thickets, and it's been pine thickets for a long time.
I've seen it in Alabama as well, too, and parts of Mississippi and Georgia and other places. But, yeah, the nature adapts to what it can survive, you know. Mm. I mean, there's exceptions where every once in a while you'll see one, and I'm sure he goes through the woods like this. You know, as opposed to going, he's learned how to look out of that left eye or that right eye because he's got his head turned that way so he doesn't get his antlers hung up on stuff.
That is so interesting. And I mean, go down that little rabbit hole, but like again, like those regional like antler characteristics and how, like you said, specific, but also body characteristics and colorations.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Because like where we're from, parts of the county or two counties that we've really grown up hunting in, you have a characteristic for a buck that will have, specifically bucks, you don't see that much with does, but almost like a jet black nose and face and a streak that goes all the way down their back, that you go to other parts of the state, you don't see that.
No.
And it, for whatever reason, you see it there pretty commonly with a lot of the bucks that get killed. So where I was kind of bringing that up is I had somebody bring, and I don't know if it was on a podcast or if it was an article I read, but someone was proposing an idea of even more genetic testing regionally to see there's true, like where you could almost have a whitetail slam from different characteristics across the country and specific populations that makes those deer a little bit different from what you'll find somewhere else.
Absolutely. Mother Nature has a way of creating or allowing that species to create something that can survive in that area. Mm. You know, maybe some will have maybe even longer hoof than the other. Chardonnays, you know, the coloration may be a little bit different. The length of the body, the depth of the body, all those kind of things. It's kind of the survival of the fittest, but it's not necessarily, it's the adaptability to that area. So those, some of them survive and some of them won't. And it may be just a very minor little difference in the body or antlers or even ear length when you got right down to it, you know.
Mm. Man, this is the most fun conversation we've had in a long time. I'm having a blast.
I'm loving it too, guys.
Absolutely. Well, Larry, really do appreciate you letting us come down here, sit down with you, talk to you about this topic. It's really fascinating. We've learned a lot, and it's got us even more excited when it comes to like learning more about whitetails. And that's what we love to do is meet individuals like yourself. You have so much more experience and expertise that thankfully you're allowing us to come here and you sharing a lot of that with us and our audience. And we're just excited to be able to have those conversations with you. So really do appreciate you letting us come down here.
It's truly mutual. And that's basically the same thing she said too, because it gets me to thinking, gets me to recalling different things. And it brings up some ideas. I go, you know, that's something else I got to look into a little bit stronger kind of thing. So thank you for the opportunity to spend time with you two guys.
Thank you so much. Well, for all the members or all the audience members out there, thank y'all for watching. Thank y'all for listening to this episode. We'll catch you back here on the next episode of the Southern Outdoorsman. And remember, guys, y'all stay Southern.
All right, I'm going to tell y'all how I like to use one of my favorite tools out in the woods, and that is the tracker from Onyx Hunt. So here's how I've been using it lately. I got this new property I'm going to be hunting this year, and the very first thing I did on the property was I went out and I drove all of the roads that are drivable in my truck. And I had the tracker on as I was driving around. So after I got done driving around, I selected the track on my app and changed it to where it's just a solid black line. So now I've got a really nice, easy to see roadmap of everywhere that's drivable in a truck on the property. So here's what that does for me so far. Now I've got an easy to read map of everywhere that you can drive in a truck on the property. But also that roadmap is actually very useful because it makes it very easy for me to see what roads are drivable and what parts of the property are most accessible and what parts of the property are least accessible. Like I said, one of my favorite tools. If you're not using it already, you should be. And if you want to give Onyx a try, go get an Elite membership and use the promo code Southern at checkout. That's going to save you 20% and it's going to help the show out. Know where you stand with Onyx Hunt. If you hunt deer out of trees, you need to go check out latitudeoutdoors.com. They got a little something for everybody, whether you're a saddle guy or if you hunt out of a climber. Of course, Latitude makes some of our favorite saddles and climbing sticks, but they also make some great packs and backpack straps that you can attach to the bottom of a climbing tree stand to make it more comfortable to carry in the woods. Probably my favorite piece of gear I've gotten in the last several years is the Ranger 22 from Latitude. It's like a do-it-all backpack for me. It's compact, which I like, but it's adjustable enough that it gets me through the whole season. It's the only pack I use. I use it in early bow season when I'm not carrying much in the woods, all the way to late January rut hunts in the Deep South when it's cold and I'm carrying all kinds of clothes and all kinds of stuff on my back. The Ranger 22 is adjustable enough that I can just use that one backpack all season. And hey, all you Mossy Oak Bottomland fans, they just released the Ranger 22 in Mossy Oak Bottomland. So like I said, no matter how you like to hunt, Latitude's got something for you. Go check them out at latitudeoutdoors.com.
Well, guys, meet your new favorite summer scouting optic. And no, it's never too early to start scouting for the fall. introducing the Vortex Crossfire spotting scopes with three different models of how you glass. Me and Andrew have both used spotting scopes in the summer to go out and glass fresh, clear cuts that's got a little bit of growth on them to find basher groups actually feeding in the summer. It's a pretty fun time, and also it's a great opportunity to take your kids out, especially if you can sit in the truck while you're glassing. And it's always one of those pieces of optics like to keep in the truck at all times because you never know when you might need it. Be sure to stop by your local Vortex dealer to get out the all-new Crossfire spotting scopes, or to get 10% off your favorite spotter, head over to eurooptic.com and enter code SOUTHERN10 at checkout to save 10% on your order.
You know, one reason that we named our company the Southern Outdoorsman is because we're not just southern deer hunters or southern turkey hunters. We kind of hunt everything: quail, doves, waterfowl, rabbits, squirrels, you name it. I know a lot of you guys are the same way, and our friends at Whitetail Hill are like that as well. Whether you've got a hunting club, a lease, or your own property, they've got a blend for pretty much every situation on a piece of ground. I mean, they've got a seed blend for everything. If you want warm season deer forage, check out Summer Bulk. If you need to screen off a plot or cover an access route, Hideaway grows up to 12 feet tall and is built for that exact purpose. You got a duck hole or a pond edge? Check out the waterfowl blend. You want to plant for doves or quail? Check out their dove and quail plot. If you need soil that needs a little bit of work before fall, check out Dirt Doctor. And of course, they got a full cool season lineup ready to go when fall planting time gets here. And if you're unsure about what to plant, go to whitetailhill.com. They've got a seed selection guide on there that'll help you pinpoint exactly what you need on your property. So y'all check them out today. That's Whitetail Hill. Go to whitetailhill.com.